This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, the Delta variant continues its march. Three states with lockdowns in place. Regional New South Wales is drawn into the fight. And back to the future. Infection rates soar in some parts of the United States as COVID tears through unvaccinated populations.
Over 97% of the people who are currently hospitalised with severe COVID were unvaccinated. And here in the United States, it's a matter of either you're going to get vaccinated or you're going to get infected.
Frustration is building in New South Wales, where the state's strict lockdown is failing to stop the latest outbreaks. The state has recorded another 110 cases and an even bigger jump in the number of people who were out in the community while infectious. It's sobering news for millions in their fourth week of lockdown, but the New South Wales Premier insists that we're yet to see the impact of the tighter restrictions. Our reporter Isabel Rowe has been monitoring the developments and joins me now. Isabel, I'm sure a lot of people in New South Wales are feeling flat after these numbers. Can you run us through the figures today?
Yeah, it's quite mind-blowing, really, Sally. 110 new cases to 8 p.m. last night from 84,000 tests, and that's another testing record, so that's some good news. 17 of those cases were in isolation for only part of the time they were infectious, and 43 people were infectious in the community for the whole time. The source of infection for 56 of those cases too is under investigation, and New South Wales Health says they are linking a lot of those cases after a bit of investigation. Cases in suburbs in Western Sydney are now an issue. They're increasing there, moving outside of the southwest. LGAs that we've seen, essential workers essentially, are spreading it at work and they're bringing it home and spreading it to their families. And so there's a new rule for workers in the Canterbury-Bankstown area. Health and aged care workers who live in that area now will need to get a surveillance test every 3 days if they work outside that area. And that's a rule that's been in place for the Fairfield local government area previously. We talked yesterday about surveillance testing, which is picking people up who don't have symptoms. And so that's how it is being spread and adding to that number of people in the community while they are infectious. The Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, was asked if she thinks it's even possible to get that number down to zero, given just how transmissible this virus is. And this was her answer.
Today I spoke about that 43 number being infectious in the community. That's the number we would like to see at zero or close to zero. And that will be based on the health advice. If that number is in settings which are low risk, well, obviously we can ease restrictions. So it's really based on the health advice and it really depends on where those infections took place. So please know that we're analysing all that data on a daily basis, but we won't know the effect of those very harsh restrictions we put in place last Friday until around the weekend or early next week.
That's Gladys Berejiklian there. And Isabel, what's the situation for regional New South Wales?
Yeah, so there's part of the region is in lockdown, which has been added to this situation in Greater Sydney. So far, there is only one worker at a pet food factory at Blaney near Orange who's tested positive, which we knew about yesterday. So nothing more announced today. The Blaney factory worker caught the virus from a truck driver who delivered goods from Sydney on Friday and Saturday last week. And so as a result, Orange and the nearby shires of Blaney and Cabon went into lockdown for a week, hopefully at midnight last night. The MP for Orange, Phil Donato, says the most important thing to him is that the virus doesn't spread further west out of that area. So he's pleading with people to do the best they can to stick it out, and hopefully it's only a week.
I would like to encourage the community not to panic, stay calm, stay vigilant, do the right thing, follow the health advice, follow the health orders. If you have any concerns whatsoever, there's New South Wales Health, there's the Service New South Wales app, or you can contact my office for assistance. We'll endeavour to do our best to help you. It's not clear cut, it's not black and white. There are certain degrees of grey amongst it, and I appreciate that. This is not an exact science. It was something that was delivered very late last night.
And Isabel, the key question, vaccination, any news on trying to speed up the rollout?
Well, there's apparently about 300,000 vaccines being administered in New South Wales alone this week, and apparently there is the capacity to do more, but they do need more GPs on board and they need more Pfizer. The Health Minister, Brad Hazzard, says there's plenty of AstraZeneca vaccine around at GPs and at those state hubs, but it's the Pfizer vaccine that there is still a shortage of at the moment. A vaccination centre at Macquarie Fields in southwest Sydney is also due to open next week. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has also been out this morning talking about the vaccination program. He's been on Adelaide radio station 5AA, where he was questioned on whether he stood by his assertion that the vaccine rollout is not a race. Those comments he'd made referring to the pace of the vaccine rollout, but Scott Morrison has sought to recast them as regarding TGA approvals. He says the government is now moving with urgency.
When that was said by both Professor Murphy and I at the time, what we were talking about was the regulation of vaccines and ensuring that the vaccines that were being used in Australia had gone through their proper approvals authorities. Now, my political opponents and of others have tried to use that. And look, that's what happens in politics. But the fact is that we have been moving with that urgency and we've been increasing that urgency.
That's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, and before him, our reporter, Isabel Rowe. Well, let's take a look across the border now, and there's been a spike in case numbers in Victoria too today, with 22 new infections recorded. But in contrast to the situation in New South Wales, all of the cases are linked to other known cases. Our reporter, Samantha Donovan, joins me now from Melbourne. Sam, good afternoon. What can you tell us about the situation?
Well, I think, Sally, the hearts of Victorians sank a bit hearing 20 new cases today. We had 13 yesterday and on Monday. But as you say, some good news, all 22 are linked to known cases. And 16 out of the 22 were in quarantine for all of their infectious period. All up, Victoria now has 107 active cases. More than 59,000 people had a test yesterday. But unfortunately, at the moment, there are three people in hospital in Victoria with COVID. Here's the state's health minister, Martin Foley, with some more detail on today's numbers.
2 days ago, there were only 6% of our daily cases were fully isolating in quarantine. Today, it is 73% have been fully isolated during their period of infectivity. So what this means is that our contact tracers and our restrictions are working in tandem as part of the public health team's toolkit to beat this virus back and to beat this outbreak back step by step. And that should give us confidence that this is a process that is working.
And Sam, what about assistance for businesses that are enduring this lockdown?
Yes, Victoria's Industry Support Minister Martin Pakula has announced more help today for them, Sally. $282.5 million extra in cash grants because of this 7-day extension to the lockdown. So that'll bring the Victorian total to about $484 million over the 12 days of lockdown. They're cash grants to the hospitality sector and other businesses as well. And Mr. Pakula says that brings the total that the state has paid out in support since May and June lockdowns to just under $1 billion.
And Sam, South Australia is in day one of its 7-day lockdown. A new case has been detected, a close contact from the venue The Greek on Halifax Street in Adelaide in the CBD, taking the cluster there to 6. What else do we know?
Yes, that new case is a close contact of another person who'd already been diagnosed. This morning, the Chief Health Officer for South Australia, Professor Nicola Spurrier, confirmed that this outbreak is linked to the Sydney outbreak. Genomic sequencing has confirmed that the 81-year-old man from Adelaide's northern suburbs, the first case, picked up the Delta variant while he was in quarantine after he'd returned to Australia from Argentina. But it's not clear where he actually actually picked it up because he had a fall in hotel quarantine and spent the rest of his quarantine period, the rest of that required 14 days in a hospital. As you mentioned, the entire state of South Australia is in day one of a 7-day lockdown. Last night, Adelaide Metro Council areas and some on the outskirts were designated by the Federal Chief Health Officer as hotspots. So that means people and businesses in those areas qualify for financial support from the Commonwealth during the lockdown. But that did create anxiety and frustration among those in regional South Australia. They're also subject to the same restrictions but don't qualify. So the Premier, Stephen Marshall, and the Treasurer of South Australia, Rob Lucas, have late this morning announced the state will provide compensation for those areas. He's the South Australian Premier, Stephen Marshall.
We know that this can move very quickly, and we do, from a health perspective, want to include Country SA in the lockdown. It's not fair for them if they don't have that income support, that disaster income support, so that will be extended statewide. In addition to that, we'll be announcing a $100 million business support package. This is going to support businesses who are suffering very significant reductions in their turnover because of these restrictions. Look, we don't want to have these restrictions in place. We don't want to have them in place one day longer than we need to. But the best advice, the expert advice, is that we need to take this action now. What we will be providing, though, is compensation to those people who are affected.
That's the South Australian Premier, Stephen Marshall, and before him, our reporter, Samantha Donovan. Overseas now, and COVID cases are soaring among unvaccinated people in the US. Despite large stocks of the vaccine and a nationwide rollout, millions of Americans are refusing to get the jab.
Over the past 3 weeks, new COVID cases nationwide have been doubling daily.
Unfortunately, the worst is yet to come. It's going to get worse before it gets better.
Now a more contagious COVID strain spreading amid low vaccination rates.
None of us thought that we'd be back in this position. But when you start to peel the onion back a little bit and understand what impacts that, which is the vaccination rates.
The state of Arkansas, which has a population of only 3 million people, is recording around 1,300 new cases each day. Only 34% of adults in Arkansas are fully vaccinated. The situation is also concerning health officials in other states, including Missouri, Florida and Louisiana. Dr. Alexandra Phelan is Assistant Professor at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University.
Over 97% of the people who are currently hospitalised with severe COVID were unvaccinated. So, you know, 97% were unvaccinated. And I think that's the big point that we're facing worldwide. The reality is we're not going to eliminate SARS-CoV-2. We may have more variants emerge, which may cause further problems. And here in the United States, it's a matter of either you're going to get vaccinated or you're going to get infected.
Have people been given a fair go to get vaccinated? Has there been access and adequate education that if they wanted to get vaccinated, they could?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point. I mean, vaccination campaigns have largely stalled, and that is predominantly because of demand. But in places like Arkansas and Missouri, you've got significant rural populations. What we're facing is this sort of this incredible uphill battle, that it's not simply a matter of dealing with the virus, it's also dealing with the governance and the politics and the leadership that are creating vacuums where getting vaccines to people is incredibly difficult, let alone people's individual hesitancy caused by misinformation and political misinformation.
What does it mean for the wider health system if there are a group of people who don't want to get vaccinated and there's a fair chance they'll end up in hospital, that they could be taking up resources that could be needed for someone who's had a car accident or some other severe illness? What about that wider context? Because COVID doesn't exist in isolation in the health system.
You know, I think it is a complex area of public health ethics, but I think foundational to that is not necessarily denying people access to life-saving treatment or medical care because of choices. You know, I think, you know, you think about, you know, other similar ethical quandaries that might have come up in the past in terms of access to transplants for, say, people who smoke or people who drink. And I think that this is an area where medical ethics and clinicians meet people where they are and when they arrive at the hospital. So I think we run a real risk of penalising an individual for an environment that is actually created by leaders is created by misinformation. And people are making these decisions within an environment that's beyond their own individual choices. And that's why it really comes back to leaders and good decisions and good leadership.
What about the political aspect of this? I saw some polling by the Washington Post saying that 86% of Democrat voters and 45% of Republicans had at least one shot. Some of this polling is showing up quite big differences in vaccination hesitancy depending on people's political persuasions.
Yeah, and I mean, this is not just from COVID. This is from decades of Republican Party undermining science and medical science and trust in science. It's from, you know, from the 2016 election and creating an environment of misinformation and mistrust of experts. You know, this is the populism and nationalism that those of us working in public health in 2016 were warning about, that infectious diseases know no borders. It knows no politics. But when you politicise science, when you politicise public health, the consequences are disastrous.
That's Dr. Alexandra Phelan, an Australian scientist working at the Centre for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Well, chaos is taking hold in parts of Afghanistan, with the Taliban reasserting itself as foreign troops leave the country. Taliban insurgents are launching major offensives, taking districts and border crossings, forcing the United States and Australia and other allies to rethink their strategies. The country's major cities and airports are still safe, but experts warn that might not last for long, as Stephanie Smale reports.
As international troops withdraw, insecurity is growing in Afghanistan. The capital, Kabul, was the latest target, with rockets landing near the presidential palace during prayers for the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha. After years on the battlefield in Afghanistan, US Marine Jason Lilly knows the enduring power of the Taliban.
The Taliban will take over. Who's going to be there to stop them? The whole point was to get rid of the Taliban. We didn't do that.
He's one American reflecting on President Joe Biden's decision to end the military mission in Afghanistan next month. And he's not convinced the decades-long war made a difference.
Was it really worth it? You know, I'm like, I don't think it was.
Border crossings and regional districts have already fallen to the Taliban, but experts argue there is still a chance to secure the major cities and airports long term. Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University.
The window of opportunity is closing very fast, and it's closing much faster than we thought it would. So at least keeping Kabul International Airport running, keeping security there, keeping the Afghan Air Force going, keeping the US Embassy and European embassies open, and then perhaps eventually stationing Australian diplomatic personnel in the US compound, that's still doable.
He says the Taliban resurgence has been much quicker and more effective than international leaders have dared to acknowledge, which has prompted a shift in their plans. The ABC has been told Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne could stage a careful return of diplomatic support in the next few months. Greg Barton says the US President Joe Biden appears to be getting the message too, with a range of concessions, including his decision to leave hundreds of personnel at the US Embassy in Kabul.
Pretty much the majority of his military and intelligence community was saying, don't treat Afghanistan as a binary decision. It's not either on or off. Keep enough residual force to put pressure on the Taliban, because they're not making good on this so-called peace treaty. And if you don't have pressure there to back up the Afghan government and military, it's going to be a terrible collapse. And I think President Biden now sees that. And I think that within Australia, we have a similar sort of divide. The government's been saying one thing, but between the lines, it looks as if the intelligence and military community has been saying we need to hang on to what we've got left in Afghanistan. Otherwise, that final collapse will wipe away all of the gains of the last two decades.
That's Deakin University Professor Greg Barton ending that report from Stephanie Smale. Well, from devastating floods to heat waves and forest fires, the world is battling a range of severe weather events. So much so, it's renewed pressure on leaders in Europe and the US to demand urgent global action on climate change. Kat Gregory reports.
Dubbed the world's lungs, the Amazon rainforest in Brazil is struggling to breathe. It's experienced fires and droughts and now flooding, with rivers swelling to levels unseen in over a century, devastating local communities. Marinaldo Florindo da Silva is a farmer in the small ranching town of Manicapuru, close to the Amazonas capital of Manaus.
Everything is hard to get. I have never seen flooding like this.
The floods are in part due to the La Nina phenomenon, but environmental experts say it's been exacerbated by global warming. Floods are also claiming lives north of the equator. Almost 200 people have died in floodwaters in Belgium and Germany in recent weeks. And now parts of central China are inundated by torrential rain and flooding, killing a dozen people and displacing more than 10,000 in the Henan province. The other weather extreme, heat and forest fires, are tearing through parts of Russia and Siberia, areas of the globe best known for its frozen landscape. A firefighter in Yakutia, northeastern Siberia, where hundreds of fires ablaze, say the situation is critical.
The fire slipped through our fire breaks. We need to make new ones.
And in the western part of the United States, authorities are struggling to contain multiple wildfires in the drought-stricken state of Oregon. The state's governor, Kate Brown, says it's another sign of the climate crisis.
We're seeing extensive drought conditions across the state, with 19 counties in drought emergencies, unprecedented heat waves, and fire seasons that are arriving earlier, coming on faster, and lasting for longer.
These extreme weather events are prompting leaders to act.
That is a consequence of the climate crisis.
That's the European Commission's Vice President, Frans Timmermans, speaking at a meeting of European Union environment ministers in Slovenia yesterday.
Everybody who talks about the cost of addressing the climate crisis should also think about the cost of not addressing the climate crisis. And I think what we've seen last week is a small reminder of the fact that the cost in human lives, but also material costs, of non-action are way, way higher than the cost of acting.
US climate envoy John Kerry is also pushing for urgent action.
I am very sorry to say the suffering of COVID will be magnified many times over in a world that does not grapple with and ultimately halt the climate crisis.
That's John Kerry ending that report from Catherine Gregory. Finally today, for more than 30 years, a massive open-cut mine in the Papua New Guinean region of Bougainville has sat abandoned. Rio Tinto had to desert the operation when violence broke out, leaving behind more than a billion tonnes of waste. Locals say it's created severe environmental and human rights issues, and now the mining giant has agreed to investigate, as our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
45-year-old George Posiona used to make a living catching fish in Bougainville, downstream from what was once one of the world's biggest gold and copper mines. But 2 years ago, mud and waste from the old mine site broke through and inundated the area where he used to fish.
The area we are standing in is our fishing area where we used to cross using canoes. Now we cannot do that anymore. We do not eat fish anymore because of the destruction.
He told the Human Rights Law Centre that he's concerned about ongoing damage.
We see that we are in big danger because this big destruction will not stop.
The Panguna mine was closed suddenly in 1989 when violence broke out at the site. The unrest turned into an almost decade-long civil war in Bougainville, which is thought to have killed as many as 20,000 people. Last year, more than three decades after the mine was shut down, the Human Rights Law Centre lodged a complaint against Rio Tinto with the Australian government. Theonila Roka Matbob, the local member in the Bougainville Parliament, helped file the complaint.
The impact that's caused by what was left behind, the legacy that was left behind, is basically everyday struggles, lack of accessibility to clean water, and also ongoing health complaints.
Today, Rio Tinto announced it would fund an assessment of environmental and community impacts. Its former subsidiary, Bougainville Copper Limited, will also contribute to the costs.
It was a relief that it's been, especially to hear Rio Tinto trying to finally accept and come down and sit on a round table.
In 2016, Rio handed over its stake in the mine to the PNG and Bougainville governments. This will mark its first return to the site. The cost of the assessment alone is expected to be a few million dollars, but it will have to go to tender. Karen Adams from the Human Rights Law Centre says this is just a first step.
This assessment will need to be followed by swift action by Rio Tinto to help actually address these impacts and clean up its mine properly. We will, you know, that is what the communities expect. That is what we will be holding them to.
In a statement, Rio says a joint committee of stakeholders will be set up so that they can consider the right way forward, and says it takes seriously the issues raised. This comes as Bougainville continues to move forward with its bid to obtain independence from Papua New Guinea, another step for the people in putting a difficult past behind them as they look to their future. This is Natalie Whiting in Port Moresby for The World Today.
And that's all from The World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along tonight. Thanks for your company. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Medicare changed at the start of this month, 900 items specifically. And if you believe some Labor politicians, it's a broadside on universal healthcare and the beginning of the end if this government has its way. But there are plenty of healthcare policy experts who say these changes are not only necessary, but overdue.
Today on The Signal, how worried should you be about Medicare? And could this fight decide the next government? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.